His knee is encrusted with shells.
You can't stay mad forever.
I'm not mad, Lisbeth says, and I'm also not going to marry you. You cheated on me.
I didn't touch Christina, JJ says. Not once did I touch her.
That may be so, Lisbeth says. But clearly there was enough electricity or chemistry between the two of you that the mere idea of her gave you a hard-on that you then went to the trouble of photographing and sending to her along with 187 texts describing what you would like to do with her if you ever got her alone in the wine cellar. The espresso Lisbeth just finished asserts itself, its liquid anger coursing through her bloodstream. You're a cheater, JJ. I will not marry you, and all the forgive me flowers in the world won't change my mind. You're a jerk for showing up here.
What do I have to do to get you to forgive me? I can't run the restaurant without you.
Hire Christina.
I don't want Christina. I want you.
I'm guessing what you really mean is that Christina was blackballed by every restaurant on this island, as she should have been, so she moved to Jackson Hole. Lisbeth can only hope this is true.
Libby, please. I'm desperate. I'm lost. And look at you, baby. You're 100 times hotter than you've ever been.
For one vainglorious second, JJ snags Lisbeth's attention. She has spent the months since they split running and riding the damn Peloton and taking private bar classes with Yolanda. She has lost 32 pounds, carved out the sides of her thighs, and scooped out her ass cheeks. She can wall sit for 2.5 minutes and plank for 3. She can hold a crow pose in yoga. She has triceps. And today, she has freed her hair from the usual braids. She's wearing it sleek and long, parted down the middle. Lisbeth has been chasing something, and that something is revenge. She has been waiting for the moment when JJ would acknowledge her change in appearance. 100 times hotter. It's a start. Far more important than how Lisbeth looks is how she feels, which is strong, healthy, motivated. She's not going to drink 8 glasses of rosé every night this summer. She's not going to share JJ's cigarettes or stay up until 3 in the morning. She's finished with that lifestyle. I need to get to work, Lisbeth says. Please leave and take back the ring.
So you're saying you don't love me?
JJ reaches in his pocket again, and Lisbeth has a sudden panic that he's going to pull out a gun and shoot her? Himself? Is he that unhinged? She takes a step back, but then sees it's just his phone in his hand.
You're telling me you can listen to this and not feel anything?
He plays White Flag by Dido. But I will go down with this ship. How many times did Lisbeth and JJ sing this at the tops of their lungs in JJ's truck as they rode to the beach at 2 in the morning so they could see the moonlight on the ocean? How many times did they dance to the song in their kitchen? I'm in love and always will be. Playing it now is unfair. What I feel is sad and disappointed, Lisbeth says. You betrayed my trust. You tossed 15 years of my love down the drain because you couldn't stop yourself from telling Christina that you wanted to tongue her nipples. JJ winces.
I never said that.
Oh, but you did. Get out of here, JJ, before I have one of my bellmen physically remove you. JJ puts the ring box in his pocket and straightens up to his full height. He's 6'5" and weighs 280 pounds. In the land of 10,000 lakes, where Lisbeth was raised, that's called a Paul Bunyan. Or I'll get a restraining order, Lisbeth says.
Libby.
He grabs her arm and she wrenches it away.
Is there a problem?
A man in a white jacket and houndstooth pants steps out of the entrance to the new hotel bar and strides over to JJ and Lisbeth.
Who is this?
Lisbeth thinks. The script on his jacket reads, Chef Mario Subiaco. Lisbeth fights to keep her composure.
Mario Subiaco?
Almost involuntarily, Lisbeth looks over at JJ. His mouth has fallen open a bit.
I'm Mario Subiaco,
Mario Subiaco says, offering Lisbeth his hand.
The chef of the Blue Bar.
The Blue Bar. Of course.
Mario Subiaco used to be the pastry chef at the Blue Bistro, which was Nantucket's best restaurant before it closed in 2005. Mario Subiaco is the OG Nantucket celebrity chef. JJ keeps Mario's picture, clipped from a profile of him in Vanity Fair that was written just after the Blue Bistro shut its doors, taped to his office wall. Lisbeth thought Mario Subiaco was in Los Angeles working as a private chef for Dwayne Johnson, but apparently he's here now. Holy buckets, Xavier, she thinks. Good job. Lisbeth Keaton, Lisbeth says, shaking his hand. I'm the general manager of the hotel. Yes, he says, I know. You're Mario Subiaco! JJ sounds like a 9-year-old Pop Warner quarterback who's meeting Tom Brady. You're a legend, man. Mario nods. Thanks. That makes me feel really old. Who are you? JJ O'Malley, he says. I'm the chef owner of the deck. Mario shrugs. Never heard of it. But as a fellow chef, I'm going to ask you to let Lisbeth here get to work. Mario checks with Lisbeth if that's what you want. Suddenly, Lisbeth is mortified that her messy personal life is on display in the parking lot like this. JJ, with his serial killer beard in his clogs, holding his phone, playing Dido, a dozen roses on the ground by his feet. Lisbeth smiles at JJ. So good to see you again. Making a clean exit, she turns on her heel and follows Mario into the building. She hears the Dido song cut off. When she looks back, she catches a glimpse of JJ staring forlornly after her. Revenge? Check, she thinks. And she feels a little sorry for him. When Lisbeth and Mario reach the service kitchen, which will be used for the complimentary continental breakfast and lunch by the pool, Lisbeth says, Thank you, but you didn't have to step in.
I saw him grab you, Mario says. I thought maybe you needed saving.
Immediately, Lisbeth's starstruck awe diminishes. I can take care of myself, Lisbeth says, and a lot of other people besides. Mario has the gall to wink at her.
I'm guessing that was your ex-boyfriend showing up to propose?
It's none of Mario Subiaco's business who it was, but Lisbeth doesn't need a feud between the hotel and the bar on the first day. There's plenty of time for that later. I should probably get upstairs, Lisbeth says.
I lied to him, you know, Mario says.
Excuse me?
I told him I'd never heard of the deck. I've been away from the island, sure, but I haven't been living on Mars. You two did some real stuff at that place, huh? A rosé fountain? Wish I'd thought of that 17 years ago. And I heard the food was banging.
Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end, Lisbeth says. Oh, but end they did. I left the deck, and I left him. We'll see what happens this summer.
Mario smirks. This summer, I steal all his customers.
God, you're cocky, Lisbeth thinks. Or maybe in her caffeine mania, she actually whispers it because Mario bursts out laughing.
I know you need to be upstairs to start your very important general managing, but can I ask your quick opinion on something?
He waves her into the gleaming white and stainless steel kitchen of the Blue Bar. Lisbeth watches him for a second, thinking she'd like to put her stiletto right up his ass. It's only 7:30 in the morning, and she's already had enough of chefs for one day. But she follows him anyway.
I was just back here doing a little mixology, Mario says. Come see.
He leads Lisbeth over to a wide butcher block made of zebra wood. They spared no expense down here. That's crowded with fruit. There are tiny wild strawberries, kaffir limes, watermelons, blood oranges, kiwi, dragon fruits, rambutans, mangoes, two kinds of cherries, Bing and Golden Rainier, guavas, blackberries, coconuts, grapefruits, and something that looks like, yes, it is, a pink pineapple. It's a fruit festival, a fruit jamboree, a fruit rave. Down the counter is the alcohol, all top shelf, Plymouth gin, Finlandia vodka, Casa Dragones tequila. Lisbeth is impressed from a cost standpoint alone.
I just need one more cocktail for my list. What do you think of this?
Mario reaches for a beaker filled with a liquid the color of a deep red sunset.
He pours it into a stemless wine glass and tops it with champagne. It's Dom Perignon, Lisbeth realizes. Mario is doing his mixology experiments with Dom. That's quite a flex. She shouldn't drink before 8 a.m. on her first day of work, but Lisbeth's focus is stretched out like a slinky, and she needs something to combat the aggressiveness of the espresso. She takes a sip. Gah, so good. Another sip in the interest of figuring out what's in the drink. Vodka? Strawberries? Ginger? Yes, there's a knob of ginger on the board. And some of the blood orange juice. She shrugs. It's fine, I guess. A slow smile crosses Mario's face, and Lisbeth takes a close look at him. In the magazine picture that hangs on JJ's office wall, Mario is much younger. Smooth olive skin, thick dark hair, and a let-me-take-you-to-bed look in his eyes. He's older now. His hair and goatee are flecked with silver. He has lines cut deep into his forehead and radiating from the corners of his eyes. But he still has the swagger, and he knows this cocktail is the best thing Lisbeth has ever tasted, that she would swim in it if she could. Well then, he says, we'll name that one for you. The Heartbreaker. Magda English might be middle-aged, but her nephew Zeke has taught her some things. She knows that the rapper Pop Smoke is dead and that Wednesdays are called Woo Back Wednesdays in his honor. She knows about Polo G, House of Highlights, The Shade Room, and all things Barstool. She knows the modern meanings of bet, sneaky link, bop, dip, bussin', and full send. And Magda knows what a Chad is. It's a young man who embodies a certain stereotype of wealth and privilege. Boarding school, college, trust fund, pastel polo shirts worn with the collars flipped up, golf, ski house, summer house, vodka soda closet, and a river of money flowing from his adoring parents. Therefore, Magda finds it amusing that the young man she's about to interview is actually named Chad. Chadwick Winslow of Radnor, Pennsylvania, the resume on fine ivory stock announces. His appearance doesn't disappoint. He has shown up to the housekeeping office in khakis, pink shirt, a tie printed with starfish holding martinis, and a navy blazer. Boat shoes without socks. He has thick blonde hair and the smooth cheeks of a child. His resume also tells Magda that he's 22, graduated from Bucknell with a major in general humanities, and was in the Sigma Phi Epsilon fraternity. His previous work experience was as a counselor at a golf camp. Although Magda has no idea what this child is doing in her office, she's not unhappy to see him. One of her four staff cleaners called to back out yesterday, the day before the hotel opened. When Magda informed Lisbeth of this, Lisbeth pulled young Master Winslow's resume out of a folder that she jokingly, or maybe not, called the last resort file. This kid stopped by the other day, insisting he wanted to clean. Honestly, I thought it was a prank, but feel free to call him and see if he was serious. When Magda called, Chad sounded eager to come for an interview and he showed up on time today. First hurdle cleared. But it could still be a prank, a bet, a dare, or a simple misunderstanding. Magda says, "You realize, son, that I'm looking for cleaning staff?" "Yes, ma'am." "You're 22, a college graduate. I could see you wanting to work the bell stand. But I don't understand why you'd want to clean hotel rooms." Chad clears his throat. "I messed up. Badly." "You won't get rich cleaning rooms," Magda says. "Have you asked about a job at the Blue Bar?"
"I want to clean rooms, ma'am."
"But why?" Magda thinks. This makes no sense.
"Do you have any cleaning experience?" she asks.
"I help my mom around the house from time to time, and I was the social chair for my fraternity, so I was in charge of setting up for parties and cleaning up afterward."
Magda shakes her head, perplexed. She thought for sure he'd applied for the wrong job. From the looks of his clothes, he has plenty of money. And yet, she can see the earnestness on his face. For some reason, he wants this job. She studies the resume.
The local address he gave is Eel Point Road, which Magda has recently learned is high roller real estate.
Did your parents make you apply for this job? Are they trying to teach you some kind of lesson?
No, ma'am. It was my idea.
Young Chadwick Winslow sounds like he's telling the truth. Magda is intrigued.
You would be the fourth and final member of our cleaning team, and as the lacrosse coach at the Episcopal School might have informed you, there is no I in team. You won't get special treatment because you're male or because you have a college degree, and there will be no exceptions made because you went to the chicken box and are feeling too hungover to clean toilets. I need you here on time and ready to work. This isn't golf camp, Chadwick. It's stripping sheets and picking up wet towels and scrubbing shower stalls until they gleam. It's dealing with other people's excrement and urine and vomit and blood and semen and hair. I hope you have a strong stomach.
I do.
Well, let's hope so, Magda thinks, because I need someone today. I'm going to gamble and offer you the job, she says. She can't believe she's doing this. There's a 99% chance the kid won't last 2 weeks. He might not even last 2 days. But Magda loves a long shot.
Thank you, Chad says. I won't let you down.
You'll start right now, Magda says. It's opening day. The rooms are all clean, and that will give me a chance to train you.
Now is great, Chad says.
He has at least enough sense to take his blazer off and roll up his sleeves.
So, what did you do? She asks. When you messed up?
If you don't mind, I'd rather not say.
It's none of my business, Magda said. I was just curious. I happen to believe, Chadwick, that even the biggest disasters can be cleaned up. And I'll teach you to believe it too.
Edie Robbins wakes up on the morning of her first day of work on the front desk, checks her phone, and sees the email from Xavier Darling.
Yes, she thinks. Yes, yes, yes.
Xavier is offering a $1,000 bonus per week. And it isn't a participation trophy. The same employee might win all 18 weeks of the season. Edie smells bacon frying. Just like every year on Edie's first day of school, there will be bacon and eggs for breakfast and tater tot hot dish for dinner. Edie's mother, Love, is trying to keep everything in their lives the same, even though nothing has been the same since Edie's father, Vance Robbins, died of a heart attack. Although Love says she's doing okay, she has taken a full-time job at Flowers on Chestnut to keep busy, Edie can sense she's still grieving. This is why Edie decided to spend the summer at home. Also, she had to get away from her ex-boyfriend, Graydon. Edie's plan is to save as much money as she can over the summer and apply for a job out in the real world, New York, Sao Paulo, London, Sydney, Shanghai, in the fall. She has a crippling student loan payment. The Ivy League wasn't cheap. So although her hourly pay is more than she anticipated, an extra $1,000 would really help. She will win it, she decides. She'll win it every week. She is ready to slay. Edie's fiercest competition for the prize money will be her partner on the front desk, Alessandra Powell. When Edie arrives at work, nearly 10 minutes early, Alessandra is already there, and she has nabbed the more desirable computer, the one closest to the open end of the desk. Edie will have to scoot by Alessandra every time she comes or goes.
Good morning, Alessandra, Edie says brightly.
Alessandra does an oh-so-quick but still noticeable up-and-down of Edie, presses her lips together, and says in a tone that is not cold but also not warm,
Good morning.
Edie wills herself not to take offense. From what Edie observed at training and during the first staff meeting, Alessandra is standoffish. Maybe not a mean girl, but maybe not a mean girl. That Edie can deal with. She has a harder time accepting that Alessandra is the front desk manager. Edie doesn't understand why there has to be a front desk manager when there were only 2 desk people hired so far. Edie realizes that Alessandra is older and has more practical job experience and speaks 4 languages. But something about Alessandra having the title feels wrong. She just walked in off the street. It's her first summer job on Nantucket.
Lisbeth doesn't know her, and neither does anyone else on this island. The night before, at dinner, Edie complained about the situation to her mother. Love worked for years as the front desk manager at the Nantucket Beach Club, and Edie's father, Vance, had been the night manager. Love sipped her wine. I bet the two of you will be best friends by the end of the summer. That's such a mom thing to say.
Sorry, Love said. I bet the two of you are going to have a tumultuous summer marked by incidents of envious backstabbing.
Envious, yes, Edie thinks now. Not only is Alessandra gorgeous and multilingual, but she's a walking, talking Pinterest board. Edie and Alessandra are wearing the same uniform, white pants and a silky hydrangea blue button-down blouse. Alessandra has accessorized her uniform with a Johnny O canvas color block belt that probably belongs to her boyfriend, but looks so cute. A pair of taupe wedge sandals and a collection of gold bangles, among which is a Cartier love bracelet that make bright jangly sounds every time Alessandra moves her left arm. Her reddish blonde hair is long, tousled, and beachy, yet not a strand is out of place. How is that possible? She's wearing white eyeliner and has a tiny crystal pressed under her right eye. At college, Edie thought eye crystals were trashy, but on Alessandra, it looks chic. How is that possible? Her name tag is upside down, which Edie thinks is a mistake, but then realizes it must be intentional, a conversation starter, because she can tell that Alessandra doesn't make mistakes. Edie, by contrast, has her hair held back in a headband, no belt, she didn't think to wear a belt, and Skechers on her feet because she was worried about being comfortable. Her name tag is right side up.
Thank you for setting up the coffee,
Edie says as she logs onto the computer next to the wall. She tries not to feel hemmed in or trapped. She feels both. Alessandra's bracelets chatter in response, and Edie thinks, fine, whatever. The coffee smells rich and delicious, and Edie wonders if she can pour herself a cup. Lisbeth didn't say one way or the other. But at that moment, Edie sees her mother's coworker, Joan, from Flowers on Chestnut, rolling in a cart laden with the bouquets for the rooms. They have guests for 11 rooms checking in today, and they've ordered a dozen Surfside Spring arrangements, enormous blue hydrangeas, pink starburst lilies, flame orange snapdragons, and blush peonies curled up into tight little balls. Joan also has a supersized version of this arrangement for the pedestal table in the lobby. Sweet Edie, Joan cries out. Look at you on your first day of work. Your mom is so proud of you.
Good morning, Joan, Edie says.
She hears Alessandra murmur, Sweet Edie? And Edie feels herself flush. That's the thing about working on your home island, she thinks. Everyone knows you, and they all call you by your mortifying nickname. She has been Sweet Edie since she was small, her father's fault. Edie moves the large arrangement to the lobby while Alessandra tasks the short, floppy-haired bellman named Adam with delivering 11 of the arrangements to the rooms. The 12th arrangement goes back in Lisbeth's office. Joan re-enters the lobby holding a planter of glorious deep purple Vanda orchids.
Those are stunning Vandas,
Edie says, showing off her orchid knowledge for Alessandra.
Are they for me?
She's kidding. That's at least $400 worth of orchids, and although Edie's mother is proud of her, they don't have that kind of money to throw around. These are for Magda English, Joan says. Seems she has an admirer.
Magda English, Edie thinks.
That's Zeke English's aunt, the head of housekeeping.
I'll take them to her.
Edie carries the orchids down the hall to the housekeeping office, where she catches Magda just leaving with a blonde guy about Edie's age, who's wearing a pink Oxford shirt and a needlepoint belt. He looks like one of the obnoxious summer kids who elbow other people out of the way to throw down their parents' credit cards at the gazebo.
Miss English, these came for you, Edie says. You have an admirer.
Magda stops in her tracks and stares at the flowers. Then tisks and shakes her head.
Put them on my desk, please, dear, she says. Chadwick and I have work to do.
Chadwick? Edie thinks, trying to hide her smile. Chad.
She sets the orchids on Magda's desk and stares at the small envelope gripped in the prongs of the plastic stake. The envelope is sealed, and Edie can't very well open it, but she's tempted to hold it up to the sunlight streaming through the window so she can see who has sent Magda English these extravagant flowers. Edie has successfully checked guests into two rooms and one suite when a family bursts into the lobby. It's a mother and two children, one girl, one boy. The mother is tall and supermodel thin. She's all flat chest and protruding hip bones, and she has what Edie can only describe as peacock hair, dyed ombre streaks of green and blue. She's either way cooler than your average mother, Edie thinks, or going through a midlife crisis. Edie is on hold with crew, attempting to secure a dinner reservation for the Katzens in room 103. She watches the little boy make a mad dash for one of the chess sets. When he picks up a knight and moves it, Edie hangs up.
Louis, the mother says, get back here this instant.
They have chess,
Louis shouts. He goes to the opposite side of the board and moves a pawn. Next to Edie, Alessandra snaps to attention and gives the family her radiant and phony smile.
Welcome, welcome to the Hotel Nantucket,
Edie calls out, stepping on Alessandra's words. Without removing her sunglasses, the peacock-haired mother looks from Edie to Alessandra as though she's arrived at a fork in the road. She seems inclined to go to Alessandra, and Edie wonders if she will be forced to suffer this rejection check-in, day after day, all summer long. Given the choice between Edie and Alessandra, people will always choose Alessandra, either because she's beautiful or because she radiates the mesmerizing self-confidence of a Kardashian. Edie waves the woman over so there can be no mistake.
I'll check you in.
Alessandra's bracelets clinkety-clank. It's the passive-aggressive sound of her discontent. Thankfully, the phone rings and Alessandra answers it. Edie splinters her attention long enough to realize that it's the hostess from crew calling back. Alessandra can handle the Katzen's dinner reservation.
Okay, the peacock-haired woman says.
She approaches with her children now firmly in hand. Both have white blonde hair and are wearing little round spectacles with thick lenses that make their eyes look like pale blue fish swimming behind glass. They're so odd-looking, they're cute.
My name is Kimber Marsh, and this is Wanda and Louis. We'd like to book a room.
I can certainly help you with that, Edie says.
Their first walk-in. Lisbeth will be thrilled. She confided to Edie that she's concerned about their low occupancy.
What kind of room would best suit your needs?
I'd say we need a room with two queens. I can't very well get them their own room, they're too young.
For how many nights?
I'd like to stay for the entire summer.
The entire summer?
Edie thinks. She starts vibrating with excitement. This is what Lisbeth has been hoping for, people hearing about the hotel and walking in off the street to book rooms.
The rate on our deluxe guest room with two queen beds is $325,
Edie says. With tax and fees, that room is $400.
That's fine, Kimber says. Please book us until...
She pulls up the calendar on her phone.
The kids have to be back in school then. Add a few days to get ready. Let's say August 25th.
Edie checks her availability, glances at Alessandra, who is just hanging up with crew, and says,
Tell you what, I'm going to give you a free upgrade to one of our family suites.
The hotel has 12 suites, and only one of them has been booked, so Edie feels fine about upgrading Kimber Marsh. The suites are divine and, in Edie's opinion, should not be left languishing. Suite 114, which is the one Edie is giving the Marsh family, has a big living area with a full wall of brand new hardcover books, all for the guests' reading pleasure, and there's a window seat overlooking Easton Street. This particular suite has a master bedroom and a whimsical room for kids, with four wide bunk beds connected by tunnels and rope bridges. There are hidden reading nooks, and there's even a swing. It's very extra. Wanda and Louis will love it.
You're upgrading us? Kimber says.
She raises her sunglasses to the top of her head so she can read Edie's name tag.
Edie Robbins, you're an angel fallen to earth.
Edie studies Kimber's face. She has bleary-looking blue eyes with brownish-purple rings beneath them. She reminds Edie of a beleaguered mom in a laundry detergent commercial. Edie fills with joy at being able to offer this nice blue and green-haired woman an upgrade. "It's my enormous and wholehearted pleasure," she says. She's overcome with a sense of professional pride and fulfillment. This is what hospitality is about, offering the guests something extra, something that makes them feel special, singled out, and tended to. "I'll just need to run a credit card." "Well, that's the thing," Kimber says. She glances at the children, who are as still as sentinels beside her. "Kids, go play chess, please, but only one game." "I don't want to play chess," Wanda says. "I want to read." She holds up a book that Edie recognizes, a vintage Nancy Drew mystery with a canary yellow back cover, The Secret of Shadow Ranch. Edie read the same edition when she was Wanda's age.
"Please, Wanda," Louie says. "I'll let you win."
Edie laughs and Kimber rolls her eyes.
"He's obsessed. He brought a travel chess set with him, of course, but he accidentally left it at the Connecticut Welcome Center, and it was a river of tears all the way up I-95. I hope you like children, because we'll never get him out of here. He'll sit at that chessboard all summer."
Edie laughs again, though a little less enthusiastically. Louie is able to drag Wanda over to the chessboard while Edie waits to hear what thing Kimber is talking about. When the children are out of earshot, Kimber says,
"I was hoping I could pay cash."
"Cash?" Edie says. The woman is booking a room for $400 a night for 81 nights, and she wants to pay cash? Kimber drops her voice to a whisper.
"I'm in the midst of a divorce, so both of my cards have been frozen because they draw on joint accounts, yada yada. I have cash, but I won't be able to give you a card, I'm afraid."
Edie blinks. Who in the year 2022 is crazy enough to think she could check into a luxury hotel without a credit card?
"The charge won't go through," Edie says. "We just put a minimum hold on it, $50 per night."
Kimber Marsh says,
"What I'm telling you is that it's not going to work. The card will be declined."
She clears her throat.
"We tried this already at the Faraway."
"Ah," Edie says. The Faraway is a fairly new boutique hotel in the center of town. If the Faraway didn't let Kimber Marsh check in without a credit card, then Edie obviously shouldn't either. But she knows it's the hotel's mission to distinguish itself from the other luxury hotels on the island. Why shouldn't they accept cash? Cash is money. But then Edie recalls the unspoken but understood reality of the hotel business. Guests lie. Their relationship with you, meaning the hotel staff, is temporary, so they feel they can say whatever they want. How many case studies did Edie read at Cornell about handling sticky situations with guests? Dozens, and yet none exactly like this. Her ex-boyfriend Graydon would probably say that Kimber Marsh was trying to pull a con, using her children as a smokescreen. She says she has cash, but what if she doesn't? And even if she does, is she just going to hand over a stack of bills? Edie needs to speak to Lisbeth.
"I'll just be one second," Edie says.
She pops into the back office and calls Lisbeth's cell, but it goes straight to voicemail. Ugh. She remembers that Lisbeth is giving a tour of the property to the couple from Syracuse checking into room 303 and shouldn't be interrupted. Every guest is a potential influencer. Alessandra comes back into the office.
"You're letting those guests wither."
"Wither, really?" Edie thinks. She's been gone less than 60 seconds. "I need to speak to Lisbeth."
"Why don't you let me take over their check-in, since you're not comfortable doing it?"
"I'm comfortable," Edie says. She brushes past Alessandra, goes back out to the desk where Kimber Marsh waits. Edie hears Louie say,
"Check me."
He starts setting the board up again while Wanda sinks back into the armchair and opens her book.
"I really need to speak to my GM before I okay this," Edie says.
Kimber Marsh leans in.
"My soon-to-be ex-husband left me for my nanny."
She emits a short, bitter laugh.
"It's such a cliche, but the reality is, I lost my spouse and my help. Craig and Jenny are spending the summer together in the Hamptons. Jenny just found out she's pregnant, so I wanted to take my kids away rather than let them stew in the cauldron that is New York City. But not having a functioning credit card is an issue. I realize this. She pauses. What if I give you the first week in cash with an extra $500 thrown on top for incidentals? She sighs. Can you work with me, please? Left her for the nanny? Edie thinks. Who's pregnant? Of course Edie can work with her. This poor woman needs her help. Kimber Marsh wants her kids to have a fun summer, and Edie is going to make that happen. And maybe win the $1,000 bonus for her superlative service. She hears Alessandra's bracelets, but she doesn't look over. She slides two key cards across the desk. I'll discuss your payment options with my GM, but for now, let's get you settled in your suite. Alessandra clears her throat. Do you have luggage? Edie asks. Yes, the gentleman out front. Kimber checks behind her. There's quite a lot of stuff. I think they're just unpacking the car. And they have Doug! Wanda reappears, though Louis has made himself comfortable over at the chessboard. Excellent, Edie says. She has no idea who Doug is. Maybe a stuffed animal. Maybe an imaginary friend. I can't wait to meet him. Since the bellmen are busy with your luggage, I'll show you the way. At this point, Edie has no choice but to turn to Alessandra. I'm just showing the Marsh family to their suite. I'll be back in a moment. Alessandra's smile is glacial. Of course. And then to Kimber, enjoy your stay, and let us know if there's anything we can do for you. No sooner does Edie emerge from behind the desk than Adam walks in with a luggage trolley, filled to the tippy top with bags. Adam catches Edie's eye and says something under his breath that Edie doesn't hear and, based on his tone and facial expression, probably doesn't want to hear. A second later, Zeke English, who graduated from Nantucket High School 2 years ahead of Edie and who is so smoking hot he makes Edie feel kind of dizzy, comes into the lobby with a dog on a leash, a lean and muscled blue-brindled pit bull. Edie knows the breed because Graydon, her ex, had a pit bull named Portia. This dog, who is wearing a black muzzle, pulls Zeke along, nails skating across the rare, wormy chestnut floors of the lobby. Edie's mouth drops open, and she looks at Zeke and then Adam, but it's clear they're both expecting her to handle this. Is this Doug? Edie chirps. Kimber's expression brightens. Yes, I put the muzzle on him in the minivan, which he was not happy about. He's a sweet couch hippo, but he can act up around strangers. He can act up around strangers, so why not bring him to a resort where there will be strangers around constantly? Edie starts to sweat. When you want to spend the summer on Nantucket with your children and your dog, you rent a house. Why didn't Kimber Marsh rent a house? It's possible she couldn't find a suitable rental at the last minute. Or maybe she didn't want the upkeep. Maybe she wanted a pool, a wellness center, and room service. There could be lots of reasons, but one thing has become clear. Edie needs to speak to Lisbeth. She's too anxious to gauge Alessandra's reaction. Will you take Ms. Marsh and the children to their suite? Edie says to Adam. I'm going to call Lisbeth. What about the dog? Zeke asks. Take him? All Edie can picture is Doug jumping up on the sumptuous white bed, chewing on the rope and driftwood frame, clawing at the white sheets, peeing on the Annie Selke rug. She gets the shivers. She figures the faraway turned the Marshes down not because of the cash, but because of the dog. Would you and Doug wait outside for 2 seconds until I speak to Lisbeth? Zeke looks put out. The dog quite obviously wants to follow the rest of the family, but Zeke shepherds him back outside. Edie glances at Alessandra, who offers ice cap eyes. She's not going to help. Okay, fine. Edie pops into the back office and tries Lisbeth again, and this time Lisbeth answers. Lisbeth, Edie says, we've had our first walk-ins. It's a woman named Kimber Marsh and her two children. They want to stay for the entire summer, and they're paying cash. Please tell me you got a credit card, Edie, Lisbeth says. She's going through a divorce, so both her cards are frozen. She said she'll give us the first week plus 500 for incidentals. Oh no, Edie.
Only now does Edie realize how absurd this sounds, and she's barely started.
I upgraded her to suite 114 because it was empty.
You upgraded her, Lisbeth says, for the entire summer? Please tell me you're joking.
Those family suites are just sitting vacant.
They'll fill up, Lisbeth says, and when they do, we'll lose room revenue on your 11-week upgrade. Edie has messed this whole thing up. If this were role-playing back in college, she would get nothing but feedback for improvement. Here in the real world, she might get fired, and she hasn't even told Lisbeth the worst part.
Also, Edie says, she has a pit bull. His name is Doug.
What? Lisbeth says. Edie kisses her dream of this week's $1,000 bonus goodbye. Chapter 6. Staff Secrets. In her century as a ghost, Grace has developed and honed her EQ. Her instincts about people are nearly always correct. Grace can sense trouble. It feels as though she's hearing a wrong note in a song or tasting a wine that has gone off. And while Grace is intrigued by the unexpected arrival of this family, she sees a flashing yellow light of warning when she looks at the mother. Kimber Marsh is lying about something. The children, however, are precious little angels, so cute and odd that Grace would like to cuddle them. The children run, shouting, into the bunkroom wonderland of Suite 114, with the dog following at a trot. The little boy, Louie, scales the ladder to the top bunk closest to the door, then clambers across a rope bridge to the other top bunk. The little girl, Wanda, tucks herself into the swing that looks like a wicker egg and opens her mystery book. Doug the dog stops just inside the threshold of the room and raises his bucket head. He starts to whine. Oh, snap, Grace thinks. He senses her. Animals nearly always do.
What's wrong, Dougie? Wanda says. Come on.
Grace floats into the master bedroom where Kimber Marsh runs a finger along the spines of the books lining the shelves. She's really quite lovely when she smiles, Grace thinks, though the green and blue hair is unsettling. And something else is off. Kimber opens the small icebox and pulls out a package of crackers, a tub of smoked bluefish pate, and, well, it is 5 o'clock in Greenland. A bottle of cranberry Pinot Gris from Nantucket Vineyards. She pours the glass of sparkling wine, then drags the cracker through the pâté and shoves it into her mouth. Grace forgives her table manners because she's so thin and needs to eat. Then Kimber slips over to the tablet by the bedside, and suddenly the room fills with music. It's Motley Crue singing Home Sweet Home. Grace hasn't heard this song since the early 90s. Kimber goes into the bathroom with her toiletries, and Grace follows cautiously. She has to avoid the mirrors just in case Kimber has, as it was popular to say in the late 90s, a sixth sense. I see dead people. Kimber glances around, sniffs the Nest candle by the tub, Amalfi lemon and mint, turns on the soft halo light around the mirror, and winks at her reflection. Okay, Grace thinks. Let's unpack this. Why would a person wink at herself? She's pulled something off? She doesn't have a penny to her name, but now she and the children and the dog are ensconced in these glorious digs? Back in the bedroom, Kimber has another cracker, and then, from the mess of luggage they brought, she fishes out a red duffel. She unzips it to reveal thick bricks of cash. So she wasn't bluffing about the money, Grace thinks. As she's stacking the cash in the safe in the walk-in closet, there's a knock at the door. Kimber tenses, then creeps out to the living room. She looks through the peephole and smiles. It's Grace's crush, Zeke, sigh, holding one of the marble chess sets from the lobby.
Edie said that Louis lost his travel chess set. She thought he might like to have a board of his own for the room.
Thank you, Kimber said. How thoughtful.
She holds up a finger. Let me get you a little something.
No need, Zeke says. It's our pleasure.
Lisbeth has just finished showing the couple from Syracuse around. The woman said she had a nice following on Instagram, and Lisbeth thought she might help spread the word about the hotel, and she's been on her feet all day long. What possessed her to wear stilettos? But when Edie tells her about the family in Suite 114, she hustles back to the office. All she can think as she collapses into her chair is that Sweet Edie was duped on day one by some grifter. She has to go to Suite 114. Lisbeth limps down the hall and knocks on the door with a smile on her face that's so forced, it makes her head ache. Kimber Marsh opens the door. Thank God Edie warned Lisbeth about the hair because it's startling. Ms. Marsh, hello. I'm Lisbeth Keaton, the general manager of the hotel. What a beautiful property you have here, she says. The kids are in heaven. Lisbeth had meant to be firm, but when the two little toe-headed children in glasses tiptoe out of the bunk room, she relents immediately. The girl is holding a book, and the boy clutches a white chess queen. I spoke with Edie, who checked you in. She told me you'd like to pay in cash, which is fine. I'll need the first week as a deposit. Yes, of course. One second. Kimber heads into the bedroom and reappears a moment later with a stack of bills. She counts it out, $3,300. The first week plus $500 for incidentals. I can pay in advance every Monday if that's easiest. In advance, every Monday works, Lisbeth says, relaxing a bit. If the woman pays in advance, there's no problem, is there? We'll slip an invoice under the door and email it to you as well. Kimber Marsh opens her arms and hugs Lisbeth, and the children run over and grab Lisbeth around the legs. Over Kimber's shoulder, Lisbeth sees the dog. He trots over to sniff Lisbeth, then plops down at her aching feet. At the end of the day, Lisbeth calls the staff to her office. Raoul, who is working night bell, agrees to watch the desk. Lisbeth gathers Edie, Alessandra, Zeke, Adam, and Magda, who is trailed by a preppy-looking kid wearing rumpled khakis and a pink Oxford shirt rolled up above his elbows. Lisbeth, let me introduce the newest member of my housekeeping staff, Chadwick Winslow, Magda says. I trained him today. The other girls won't be in until the morning. Chad Winslow, the kid says, shaking Lisbeth's hand. That's right. I remember when you dropped off your resume. I'm glad this worked out. Welcome. Chad dips his head. Thank you for the chance. I'm grateful. Chadwick Winslow sounds like a name straight off the Mayflower Manifest, but Lisbeth wants to foster diversity and inclusivity across the board. Why shouldn't a rich-looking dude named Chad be cleaning rooms? Lisbeth leads everyone into the break room, which has been decorated to resemble a 1950s diner. There's this signature turquoise and orange of a Howard Johnson's and a lot of chrome and formica. It provides a complete psychological separation from the rest of the hotel, which is important when everyone is working 6.5 days a week. There's a bar counter where the staff can sit and eat lunch, a low, curvy sofa with plenty of pillows for napping, a soft-serve ice cream machine, a vintage pinball machine, hocus-pocus, and a jukebox that gives 4 plays for $1. Lisbeth is seriously impressed by the break room, but for the most part, the staff seem nonplussed. Zeke stares at the pinball machine like it's a Martian spacecraft, and Lisbeth can see him wishing there was a TV and a PS5 instead. Edie inspects the songs on the jukebox and says, I've never heard of any of this music. Who's Joan Jett? Lisbeth asks everyone to sit and then checks that the door is closed tight. First of all, I want to thank you all for your great work today. She brings her hands together in front of her chest. The incident with JJ and Mario Subiaco that morning in the parking lot feels like 3 days ago, and Lisbeth has to stay to work the night desk. How is she ever going to make it through the summer? She isn't at this rate, and especially not in heels. We have guests in Suite 114 who will be staying for the summer. I just want to remind everyone that although these guests may become very familiar to you over time, you should always treat them with the highest standards of service. And information about all our guests should be held in the strictest confidence. Of course, Edie says. Everyone else just nods.
Something about Kimber Marsh's cash felt fishy, and after the children and Doug retreated back to their room, Lisbeth had wanted to ask Kimber a question, but she wasn't sure what that question should be. Was her ex-husband abusive? Was he in the mob or a drug dealer? Was the family in hiding? In the end, Lisbeth said to Kimber, "We're so glad you're here. I wrote a Nantucket recommendation guide, which I'm calling the Blue Book. I'll leave it for you at the desk." Then Lisbeth zipped down to her computer and Googled Kimber Marsh of East 74th Street, New York, New York. Nothing relevant came up. Lisbeth checked Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Nothing. She tried Kimberly Marsh, Kim Marsh, Kimmy Marsh. Still nothing. As far as the internet was concerned, Kimber Marsh didn't exist. Was that suspicious? Lisbeth reasoned that there were lots of people who didn't use social media. Or maybe because of the divorce, she had deleted her accounts. To the staff, Lisbeth says, "I've advised Ms. Marsh to use the exit next to her suite to walk the dog. The last thing I want to see is that dog strolling through the lobby." "I'll walk the dog for Ms. Marsh if she needs me," Zeke says. Edie laughs. "Seriously? This afternoon, that dog was walking you." "We bonded," Zeke says. "It'll be my pleasure to do that for Ms. Marsh."
"He just wants the $1,000 bonus," Adam says.
"About those bonuses," Lisbeth says, and every pair of eyes snaps back to her. "In addition to reading the Travel Tattler reviews, Mr. Darling will be hearing from me about staff performance. And what I'll be looking for is superlative guest service, of course, but also selflessness, sacrifice, promptness, consistency, kindness, and teamwork." Alessandra, who has been sitting on the sofa with her arms crossed, raises a hand. "Will Mr. Darling be in residence this summer?"
"Not until August."
Alessandra frowns, but the rest of the staff look relieved. Adam raises his hand.
"Can we get the piano in the lobby tuned?" he asks.
"Sure," Lisbeth says. Until this second, she thought of the piano only as a piece of furniture. "Do you play?"
"I do," Adam says. He sings out, "Welcome to the Hotel Nantucket," to the tune of Hotel California, and everyone except Alessandra smiles. He has a great voice, a Broadway voice, just like his former GM said in the email.
"I'll put that on my list," Lisbeth says. She looks around the room. "Does anyone else have hidden talents?" She pauses. "Or perhaps a secret to share in this safe space?" She watches every face in the room tense up. Lisbeth smiles. "Just kidding, guys. Thank you for a terrific first day." Lisbeth isn't kidding. She wants to nurture intimacy and trust. During her 15 seasons at the deck, Lisbeth was a vault for all sorts of sensitive information. She was the first call when Goose's brother got arrested for a DUI. She sat with Juliet in the restaurant office while Juliet cried about accidentally getting pregnant. However, Lisbeth kept boundaries in place. She was 90% boss, 10% big sister. Her staffers were a little afraid of her, but that meant she was doing a good job. She wants to create that same atmosphere here. It's her strength. She scrutinizes her staff. If they're hiding anything, as she suspects Kimber Marsh is, she wants to know about it now. Chad Winslow leaves the staff meeting and drives his brand new Range Rover back to his parents' summer house on Eel Point Road. Secrets? He thinks. There's no way Lisbeth could have heard what happened back in Pennsylvania, but the question made him uncomfortable. He checks his phone only long enough to see that it's clogged with texts and snaps from his summer friends, but there's nothing from Patty, which is both agonizing and a relief. Chad has texted Patty every day since he arrived on the island, but he's heard nothing back. Patty is finished with Chad, hates his guts, will never speak to him again. And the thing is, Chad can't blame him. As Chad rumbles down the dirt road past the grandest beachfront homes on the island, he recalls Ms. English's words. "I happen to believe, Chadwick, that even the biggest disasters can be cleaned up, and I'll teach you to believe it too." Chad wants to believe it. He wants to think that,
If he works hard and keeps his eyes straight ahead, he'll be able to scour the ugly stain from his life. Ms. English and Chad spent all day in room 104, which was already impeccably clean. She stripped the sheets off the Emperor-sized bed, and he started from scratch, pulling the fitted sheet tight around the corners. "Nothing worse than a rumpled bottom sheet," Ms. English said. She showed him how to arrange the pillows. She made him take a picture of the finished product as though it were an art installation. They spent 2 hours in the bathroom alone, going over all the places on a toilet where bacteria hides, how to find and dispose of stray hairs and clipped nails, how to get water stains off the drinking glasses, and how to fold a towel, which was harder than it looked. Chad folded the same towel 62 times, starting over if the edges weren't straight. They ran through the 100 points on the checklist, including the tiniest details that Chad never would have thought about. The number of hangers in the closets, whether all the light bulbs worked, and the temperature of the mini fridge. Ms. English gave Chad strict instructions about which of the guests' belongings it was okay to touch. He was to fold discarded clothes and place them on the surface closest to where he found them. "The guests will always leave their underwear draped over the telephone," Ms. English told him, which made him laugh. He hoped she was kidding. He was never to touch jewelry, watches, or cash unless it was a checkout and the cash had been left as a tip. He was never to go into the drawers, the closet, or a suitcase. "Obviously," Chad said, and Ms. English had given him a pointed look. Did she think he was a thief? He hadn't told her how he'd messed up, so it was possible she thought he'd stolen something. That was practically the only thing he hadn't done. When Chad pulls into his driveway, he sees his friend Jasper's Porsche Cayenne parked there, and Jasper, Bryce, and Eric are standing on the front porch. Chad aims the air conditioning vents straight at his face and wishes he could disappear.
"Where you been, bruh? Snapping you all day. We finally decided to storm the castle, but your sister said you weren't home, and when we asked her where you were, she said she hoped you were bleeding in a ditch."
"Ouch," Chad says, though this comes as no surprise. Leaf hates him now.
"She's cold," Bryce says.
"And yet so hot," Eric says.
Chad doesn't have the energy to flip Eric off for that. He's more concerned about the sweet green miasma hanging in the air above his friends.
"You guys smoked up on my porch?"
"We were waiting for you, man. We're hitting the brewery. You have to come."
"I can't."
"What?"
Eric says.
"Band is back together, bruh. Come on. Didn't you miss us?"
The answer is no. Chad is still friends with these guys, the young princes of Greenwich, Connecticut, Mission Hills, Kansas, and Fisher Island, Florida, only because of their shared past. They threw sand at one another on Children's Beach, sneaked into R-rated movies at the Dreamland Theater, showed up late to steak night at the Sankaty Head Golf Club with their Oxfords half untucked and their eyes bloodshot because they'd smoked out of an apple pipe at Altar Rock. But thanks to his friendship with Patty, Chad has gained a modicum of self-awareness. He realizes that the Chad stereotype, passing out in public, like Jasper in front of the gazebo on Figawi weekend, or stranding a car on the beach, like Eric in his father's Mercedes at Fisherman's, is not only privileged and elitist, but also ridiculous and pathetic.
"What do you call a group of Chads?"
"An inheritance." However, this self-awareness, of which Chad is secretly proud, was tragically lacking on May 22nd. Chad is amazed these guys haven't heard what happened back in Radnor. He half expected his sister Leith to spill the beans, even though their parents swore both children to silence for the sake of the family name. Still, Chad knows that gossip flows fast along tributaries slicked by money and privilege. How did news of the party not reach these three? Or maybe it did, and they just don't care. The brewery sounds like fun. They can have a couple cold whale's tails, get some lobster sliders from the food trucks, check out girls, listen to live music, pet other people's golden retrievers. No, Chad thinks, no dogs. He'll go for an hour, he thinks, to appease them. But then he recalls how an hour or two at the brewery can easily turn into drinks at the gazebo, which will then become the four of them lined up in the front row of the chicken box, pumping their fists in the air to some cover band singing Coldplay before spilling out onto Dave Street and puking out the back of a cab. Chad needs to be at work bright and early tomorrow. He will not show up hungover.
"Good seeing you guys," Chad says. "Man, what's going on?" Bryce says. "You didn't open a single snap all day, and now you won't go out with us?"
Chad knows his behavior must seem strange. He's never been the ringleader of this group. That has always been Jasper. But in summers past, he's gone along for a good time.
"Where were you all day?" Jasper asks.
Chad says. He could tell these guys he got a job, but there would be follow-up questions like where and why. Chad is supposed to be having one last summer of carefree leisure before starting at his father's venture capital firm, the Brandywine Group, in September. How can Chad explain that not only is he working this summer, he's a chambermaid? He spent today in rubber gloves, learning about disinfectants.
"Maybe I'll meet you guys later."
He reaches for the doorknob so there can be no mistake, he's not going anywhere with them. Eric cracks a big, high smile.
"Chad must have himself a lady friend. Look at his fit. Did he even come home last night?"
Jasper and Bryce start catcalling.
"Bros before hoes, man, but no worries, we're gonna dip. We'll hit you up later."
As Chad slips into the cool air of the foyer and closes the door behind him. Leith is coming down the stairs. She flips him off and heads for the kitchen without a word. His sister has recently earned her doctorate in the silent treatment, which hurts because they used to be friends. A second later, he hears his mother, Whitney, "Chatty?" If she's calling him the world's worst nickname, Chatty, then she's already into the Chardonnay. Chad pokes his head into the kitchen and sees Whitney standing at the island with a large, uncorked bottle of Kendall Jackson in front of her. She flutters a piece of paper in his direction.
"Pretty please," she says. "Mark it for Mom."
He takes the list. 8 Wagyu steaks, 3 pounds bluefin tuna, 2 pounds lobster salad, Comté cheese, truffled potato chips, 6 bags.
"This is a lot of food," he says. "Are we having company?"
Whitney shrugs and casts her eyes down into the golden promise of her wine.
"Things for dinner."
Chad's father won't arrive on the island for another few weeks. He's busy closing a deal. Leith consumes only 2 things, hard-boiled eggs and Diet Dr. Pepper, and Whitney eats even less than that. Yet his mother always stocks the fridge like the offensive line of the Philadelphia Eagles are coming for dinner. When she goes to the trouble of cooking, 90% of the food is pitched straight into the trash. Neither of Chad's parents believe in leftovers. But most of the time, Whitney can't be bothered to cook. Instead, she pours wine, microwaves a bag of popcorn, and gets lost in Netflix. Or she meets the girls at the yacht club, and the groceries sit in the fridge until they grow a slimy film or greenish-gray fur. This never bothered Chad. He never even noticed until Patty went on a tirade about the conspicuous waste of the Winslow household. He'll buy 3 steaks, the cheese, and 1 bag of potato chips, he decides.
"I got a job today," he says.
"You did not."
These are the first words Leith has spoken to him since May 22nd.
"At the Hotel Nantucket," Chad says, "cleaning rooms."
His mother blinks.
"I wanted to do something," Chad says, "to make things right."
"Your father is handling it with the lawyers," his mother says.
"I wanted to do something. Get an honest job. Make my own money to give to Patty."
"Oh, sweetheart," Whitney says.
"Wait," Leith says. "You're serious? You're going to clean rooms at the hotel? You're going to be a
maid," Chad says.
He watches his sister smile, which is nice because she has such a pretty smile and he hasn't seen it in a while. But then she dissolves into hysterical laughter that quickly becomes more hysteria than laughter and finishes as ugly sobs. She takes the closest thing she can find, a coffee mug with a picture of a dachshund on it, and throws it at him, hurling it like she's trying to get a lacrosse ball into the net for the game-winning goal against a longtime rival. She misses Chad. The mug smashes against the tile floor.
"You can't make things right," she screams.
Chad leaves the kitchen and heads out the front door with the list clenched in his fist. His sister is correct. He can't make things right, but he's going to die trying. Since arriving on Nantucket last August and moving into the guest cottage behind her brother's house on Westchester Street, Magda English has established a tidy and modest routine. She attends the 7:30 service at the Summer Street Church every Sunday morning. She occasionally meets the church ladies, led by the sanctimonious and nearly unbearable Nancy Twine, for afternoons of crafting, and she cooks soups, stews, and rice dishes, all of them diabolically spicy. When Magda leaves the staff meeting, she chuckles to herself. Does anyone have a secret to share in this safe space? Magda has secrets, but she isn't fool enough to divulge them to people she's just met, most of whom aren't old enough to remember the turn of the millennium. She finds it amusing that their new general manager, a woman well into her 30s, is naive enough to believe that any space is safe. If Magda were going to lead by example and share something, it might have been this. She's thrilled to be working again. Her tidy and modest routine had grown dull. She was bored, and more than once she had checked flights back to St. Thomas. She'd retired from cruise ships for good, but there was a new resort opening on Livongo Key, and she thought she might head up housekeeping there. But then she'd heard from Xavier, who told her what he'd done, bought a hotel, sight unseen, on the island where she now lives. Xavier is like a schoolboy doing handstands and backflips to capture Magda's attention, only in his case, the acrobatics are displays of his wealth. The way he managed to get the renovation done so quickly, the $1,000 bonuses for the staff, and sending the orchids that morning. Vandas are Magda's favorite flower, as Xavier well knows. She'd left them on her desk. If she brought them home, she would be asked all kinds of questions that she had no intention of answering. Magda slips out of the hotel and climbs into her brand new Jeep Gladiator, which is part Jeep, part pickup truck, and a convertible to boot. Her brother William had given her quite a look when she drove it home from Don Allen Ford. He was certainly wondering how she'd paid for it. She said, "I've lived on ships for so long that all I ever dreamed about was a new car, so I splurged." If he wasn't exactly satisfied with her explanation, that was his problem. Magda has errands to do. She stops first at Hatch's for a fresh bottle of Appleton Estate 21 rum. She constantly seeks out reminders of the Caribbean. And, because she can't help herself, she also buys a $10 scratch ticket. When she gets back out to her car, she scrapes the silver coating off with a dime from her change purse. Ha! She's won $500. She'll go back in to collect it next time. She considers stopping by Bayberry Properties to see if Fast Eddie has any more listings for her to check out. But she doesn't like the way Eddie's sister, Barbie, looks at her. So she decides to send Eddie a text. "Please don't forget about me, Mr. Pansick," she writes. To his credit, Eddie responds right away. "I could never forget you, Magda. I'll circle back later this week with a list, as we discussed." Magda loves William and Ezekiel to pieces, but it's time she got her own place, especially now that it looks like she's staying. She has one more errand to run, the Nantucket Meat and Fish Market. Magda wants to get soft-shell crabs. She'll sauté them in brown butter and serve them with dirty rice and roasted asparagus. The market is pleasantly chilly and smells like coffee. It houses the only Starbucks concession on the island. Magda heads for the bounty of the long refrigerated butcher case, where she finds impeccable trays of ribeyes, individual beef wellingtons, steak tips in three different marinades, chicken breasts stuffed with spinach and cheese, plump rainbows of vegetable kebabs, baby back ribs, lamb chops, lobster tails, jumbo shrimp cocktails, cilantro lime salmon, and swordfish steaks as thick as paperback books. The line at the case is 4 or 5 people long, but Magda doesn't mind waiting. It's the first time she's stopped moving all day. The hotel has turned out beautifully, she has to admit. But of course, Xavier never does anything halfway. If you're not planning on being the best, why do anything at all? Isn't that what Xavier said the night she met him 1 million years ago, back when he first bought the cruise line? He'd addressed the staff in the Tropicana Theater. Everyone had been thrilled, Magda included, because it was an hour of free drinks. Magda can still picture Xavier, upright and self-important in his bespoke suit. That was over 30 years ago now, the night her fortune changed. Xavier is coming to the island in August. Magda will make sure his suite is spotless. Just thinking these words makes Magda laugh, which attracts the attention of the young man standing in front of her. He turns around. Oh, he says, hey, Ms. English. For the love of Pete, Magda thinks. It's her long shot. She has a hard time coming up with the boy's name, even though she spent all day with him, showing him how to vacuum in neat rows, how to scrub the oyster shell tiles with an electric toothbrush. They'd covered a surprising amount of ground, though it was immediately clear the child had never so much as cleared his plate from the dinner table. They still have the laundry to tackle. Folding a fitted sheet, will he ever master it? They also need time to go over the sensitive things maids come across. Sex toys and props for role-playing, birth control pills, condoms, diaphragms, tubes of lubricant, falsies, and drug paraphernalia. She doesn't want him to be shocked. Hello. She can't for the life of her remember his name. Did she use it today? She must have. Her mind grapples for it the way her hand feels around on her nightstand for her glasses in the dark of the early morning. Chad, he says. She starts giggling. She can't help it. She bows her head and chortles into her cleavage, her body rocking with laughter. It's so funny, not only her forgetting his name when she was with him all day, but also the name itself, Chad, when he appears, outwardly anyway, to be precisely that Nantucket type. A Chad named Chad. Magda laughs so hard, her stomach muscles ache, and tears leak out of the corners of her eyes. Chad is staring at her, as are a couple of other people in line, which begins to sober her. But then Magda catches a glimpse of Chad's expression, and it's so befuddled that Magda doubles over again. She's making a ticking noise that doesn't even sound like laughter, but it's all she can eke out. She's probably 30 seconds away from someone calling an ambulance. Now it's Chad's turn to step up to the counter and order. He asks for 3 Wagyu fillets, and although Magda has known the boy for less than 12 hours, this is exactly what she would have guessed his family eats for dinner. Magda is finally able to catch her breath and compose herself, though little bursts of laughter continue until Chad turns around with his wrapped parcel and smiles uncertainly at her. See you tomorrow, Ms. English, he says. See you tomorrow, Longshot, she says. His smile widens. He can take a little ribbing. And Magda feels a pulse of optimism. She wonders if her gamble might work out after all. Edie steps out of the meeting and thinks, is it just me or has this day been 3 weeks long? She checks her phone. There's a Venmo request for $500 from her ex-boyfriend. No, Edie thinks. This feels like a mistake or a joke, but a chill runs through her. Graydon is out in the parched, cracked desert of Arizona. He accepted the job with Ritz-Carlton at its Dove Mountain property, the job they applied for together and planned to take together. But then things with Graydon got weird and awful, and Edie changed her mind about the Ritz and decided to come home instead. Graydon, who by that point was obsessed with Edie, asked if he should come to Nantucket too. He said he would live with Edie and her mother, Love. But Edie said she didn't think that was a good idea. What she meant was that she didn't want Graydon on Nantucket. What she meant was that she wanted to break up. Edie had assumed she would work at the beach club like both her parents had, until her mother offhandedly mentioned that the Hotel Nantucket, which had been an eyesore and a blight throughout Edie's childhood, was undergoing a rumored $30 million renovation. Edie wanted to be part of a team restoring a historic hotel to its former glory, and she would be safe. The waters surrounding the island would be nearly amniotic, protecting her from Graydon. Except that now, here he is in her Venmo requests. A couple walks across the lobby, dressed for dinner. Edie has nearly forgotten that there are guests in the hotel other than Kimber Marsh, her children, and their pit bull. It's the Katzens, Edie thinks, on their way to crew. They wave as they head out the door. If Edie were playing her A game, she would walk out with the Katzens, chat them up. After all, she had told Lisbeth in her interview that the most important aspect of hospitality was making a connection with each and every guest at the hotel. But she does nothing and says nothing because she has a trash fire on her phone. $500? She walks home to Sunset Hill, thinking there's no way she's going to let Graydon blackmail her. She deletes the Venmo request. He has some nerve. A text comes in. Edie hopes it's her mother saying the tater tot hot dish is ready. But when Edie checks, she sees the text is from Graydon, an emoji of a movie camera. She has to pay him. But she can't. She has a student loan payment due on June 15th that's nearly half of her first paycheck. She won't pay him. Who will he send the videos to? She's not famous. The National Enquirer doesn't care about her. And their mutual friends are woke enough that they'll realize Graydon is using his white male privilege to get back at Edie for breaking up with him. They'll delete the videos without watching them, she hopes, and cancel Graydon. But what if Graydon sends the videos to her mother? Can Edie risk that? Love had had Edie when she was 40. Now she's 62 years old, and although she tries to stay current, she knows who Billie Eilish and Doja Cat are, she doesn't quite understand the new sexual norms or the ways that Gen Z live their lives on their phones. Love probably doesn't think that Edie's still a virgin, but as close as they are, they never discuss sex. No! Edie binged the second season of Euphoria with her bedroom door not only closed but locked. If Love saw Edie in the videos that Edie had allowed Graydon to take, she would die inside. Edie is Love's pride and joy, her prize and treasure, and her obsession with Edie has only grown more intense since Vance died. The worst thing would be if Love blamed herself for those videos, thinking that she didn't raise Edie right or set a good example. Edie Venmos Graydon the $500, which is most of what she has in her bank account. It's her graduation money. She wants to scream into the beautiful June afternoon, but she's afraid one of her neighbors on Sunset Hill will hear her. She gets another text, from Graydon, of course. TY, it says, with the thumbs up emoji. The last person to leave the break room is the one Grace most wants to see leave, Alessandra Powell. Grace hovers above as Alessandra drops four quarters into the jukebox. These are quarters that Grace watched Alessandra lift from petty cash and pick songs, all of them the devil-worshipping heavy metal of the 1980s. Wow, Grace hasn't missed this music at all. She tries to spook Alessandra, positioning herself so that her figure in the white robe and Minnesota Twins cap might be reflected in the plexiglass of the pinball machine that Alessandra has started playing. Grace does a little headbanging dance to amuse herself and get Alessandra's attention. Does Alessandra see her? No. She remains wholly focused on keeping the silver ball in play. Grace blows cold air down the back of Alessandra's neck, but she doesn't seem to notice that either. This can mean only one thing. The girl has demons inside her. Grace can practically hear their taunts.
You can't scare us. Nothing scares us.
A second later, Grace realizes she's not the only one suspicious of Alessandra. There's someone else lurking just inside the door. Lisbeth isn't worried about the private life of Zeke or Adam or Chad or Edie, and she certainly isn't worried about Magda. Alessandra is another story. Right before the staff meeting, Mac Peterson from the Nantucket Beach Club called to congratulate Lisbeth on opening day and ask how things were going. Mac did this in good faith despite the fact that they're direct competitors. Lisbeth knows Mac from her days at the deck. She couldn't keep herself from bragging, "I have sweet Edie on my desk."
"You know I'm envious. She's my godchild."
"And I ended up hiring that woman, Alessandra, the one who had been working in Italy?"
Mac said, "I'm not sure who you mean."
"Wasn't she supposed to interview with you? Alessandra Powell? For your front desk?"
Mac said, "I didn't have any front desk positions open this year. The only position I hired someone for was night bell. I got lucky and nearly my entire staff from last year returned."
"Oh," Lisbeth said. She was stymied for a second. Hadn't Alessandra said she was interviewing with Mac at the beach club? She had. She told Lisbeth that Mac had basically offered her a position on the desk. "Well, let's hope I get that lucky next year." Alessandra had lied, and that didn't feel great. Lisbeth should have been more guarded during their interview, but Alessandra had charmed her, bringing Lisbeth a sandwich when she knew she was interviewing right before lunch. How canny, how clever, how manipulative. And then she dodged the questions about her references. This manager retired, this one died, there is no one in all of Europe who can vouch for my performance. Lisbeth had called all four of the hotels listed on the resume, and only at one hotel, the Grand Hotel Tremezzo, had she found someone who could verify that yes, Alessandra Powell had worked there for 2 years, but no, nobody was around at that moment who had known Alessandra personally. Lisbeth left messages at the other three hotels and is waiting for them to call back. Though, what is she going to do now? Fire Alessandra? The woman is exceedingly professional on the desk, and she's stunning to look at. She's beautiful enough to get away with murder. Lisbeth is about to start her shift on the night desk. They need a night auditor. When she realizes she saw everyone on her staff leave the hotel except Alessandra. Lisbeth cracks open the door to the break room. Alessandra is standing at the pinball machine, gyrating her hips like she's making love to the thing, and the machine is dinging and flashing its lights like it's enjoying it. The jukebox is playing "Same Old Situation" by Motley Crue, which Lisbeth hasn't heard since she listened to 92 KQRS back in the Twin Cities growing up. When the game is over, Alessandra must be pretty good because it lasts longer than half the men Lisbeth has been with, and the song changes to "Highway to Hell" by AC/DC. Nearly every song on the jukebox is from the previous century. Alessandra steps up to the soft serve ice cream machine and swirls herself a gigantic bowl of chocolate. She digs in like she hasn't eaten in days. "Hey," Lisbeth says, stepping into the room. Alessandra blinks. Her wavy, apricot-colored hair falls over one shoulder. "We haven't really had a chance to chat," Lisbeth says. "Chat?"